Welcome back to Insurance Insights, a financial reporting podcast where we unpack the latest statutory accounting, regulatory, and actuarial developments from the NAIC. I'm your host, Sean, a partner in our insurance practice. Before we dive into the specific outcomes of the NAIC's spring meeting, I thought it would be valuable to set the stage by looking at the broader regulatory picture. The NAIC recently released its strategic priorities for 2026, themed around leadership, modernization, and resilience, which gives us a clear roadmap for the future. To walk us through these priorities and dive deeper into the 2026 NAIC spring meeting developments, I'm joined once again by Olga Roberts, Managing Director in the Department of Professional Practice. Olga, it's great to have you back. Can you outline these strategic priorities for our listeners?
Thanks, Sean. It's a pleasure. And yes, I think starting with this high-level view is important. It helps connect the dots between the individual projects we'll discuss today and the NAIC's overarching goals. The NAIC has laid out four key priorities for 2026. The first is enhancing capital and investment frameworks. This is all about ensuring that as the marketplace and the investment environment change, the capital and investment rules are robust enough to ensure insurers can keep their promises to policyholders. We see this directly in the ongoing efforts to update RBC factors for complex assets like CLOs. The second priority is enhancing data architecture, predictive analysis, and market analysis. Here, the NAIC targets to strengthen its own capabilities as a data aggregator and early warning monitor. The goal is to be more proactive in identifying risks and supporting regulatory oversight across the states.
And the other two seem to focus heavily on emerging risks and technology.
Exactly. The third priority is increasing resilience through regulation, mitigation, and public partnership. This is a direct response to the growing threat of natural disasters. We'll see this translate into more guidance on catastrophe modeling, climate-related stress testing, and disclosures, all aimed at closing protection gaps for consumers. And finally, the fourth priority is leading on AI model governance, innovation oversight, and cyber threats. This is perhaps the most forward-looking pillar. The NAIC is making it clear they want to be on the front foot with technology. This priority is the driving force behind two major topics we'll cover today: the new AI evaluation tool being piloted right now, and the proposed regulatory framework for the third-party data and model vendors that insurers rely on. In short, these four priorities are the why behind the what. They tell us that every new proposal and every working group discussion is part of a larger strategy to modernize regulation and protect consumers in a rapidly evolving world.
That's a helpful and concise explanation, Olga. Thank you. It provides excellent context for the detailed developments we're about to discuss. So with that strategic framework in mind, let's get into the outcomes of the spring 2026 meeting. The regulators have continued to be busy adopting some key guidance we discussed last time and exposing a new wave of proposals that will shape the industry for years to come.
You're right. The spring meeting was very active. We saw final adoption of some significant guidance related to interest maintenance reserve. But perhaps more importantly, we got a better look at major new proposal for derivatives used in asset liability matching and a proposal to disclose information related to funding agreements.
Let's start with a topic that was a major focus of our last conversation, the interest maintenance reserve, or IMR. You previously mentioned two key exposures, the IMR proof of reinvestment and the treatment of IMR in reinsurance collateral. Where did the NAIC land on those?
This is a great place to start, as we have a definitive answer on one of them. The Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group adopted the new statutory accounting concept for IMR proof of reinvestment. This is the guidance designed to validate that an insurer is reinvesting loss-generating sales into higher-yielding investments before they can defer negative IMR balance.
Can you refresh our listeners' memories on how that works?
Certainly. to defer loss recognition through negative IMR balance, an insurer will now have to pass two new tests. The first is the reinvestment test, which verifies that the cost of fixed income investments purchased exceed the proceeds from sale plus investable premium. The second is the weighted average yield test, which ensures the yield on the newly acquired investments is higher than the yield on the investments that were sold. If an insurer fails these tests, any additional realized losses can't be deferred through IMR and must be recognized immediately in surplus.
That's a significant piece of guidance finalized. Has this become effective?
Not yet. Although the concept has been adopted, this concept, as well as other IMR-related items that have been adopted in past meetings, are included in the updated SSAP number 7 and a related issue paper, which were exposed after the spring meeting. The exposure is through June 22nd of this year. One important reminder to our listeners is that INT 2301 that allows net negative IMR to be admitted, subject to certain limitations, is scheduled to be nullified on January 1st, 2027.
What about the second IMR proposal, the one on the proposed revisions to SSAP number 61 to clarify how IMR derecognized in a reinsurance transaction influences the collateral required for reinsurance credit for unauthorized or certified reinsurers?
That one is on a bit of a slower track. If you remember, this proposal would require what Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group calls an asymmetrical treatment. This means a ceding insurer would have to increase the collateral requirement for any net positive IMR that is derecognized in a reinsurance transaction, but they would be prohibited from decreasing the collateral requirement for any derecognized net negative IMR. There has not been any action on this proposal yet because the Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group is waiting for feedback from the Reinsurance Task Force before moving forward. As we discussed last time, there was significant industry feedback advocating for a symmetrical approach, and the American Academy of Actuaries proposed an alternative approach. So there is still more to come on this proposed revision.
It's good to have clarity on the proof of reinvestment, but we'll have to keep watching the reinsurance collateral piece. Let's pivot to what's next on the horizon. In our last episode, you mentioned a new SSAP was being drafted for derivatives used in asset liability management. What's the latest there?
That's right. The Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group has now exposed a new proposed standard, SSAP number 109, specifically for interest rate hedging derivatives used in asset liability management. This is for derivatives that do not qualify for hedge accounting under the existing rules, but are critical to the insurer's macro hedging strategy.
That sounds like it could fill a major gap for the industry. What would the new accounting entail?
The proposal is largely consistent with the treatment previously proposed by interested parties. It uses an amortized cost approach. The insurers would be able to measure these hedging instruments at amortized cost, which avoids the surplus volatility of fair value accounting and aligns better with how hedged assets and liabilities are reported. However, to use the special accounting, an insurer must have a clearly defined hedging strategy, get approval from its domiciliary state regulator, have a financial officer certify that the strategy is being used in its day-to-day risk management. The proposed effective date is January 1st, 2027, so it is on the fast track.
Olga, in our last episode, we talked about a couple of new proposals that seem to be going back to basics, reviewing some really fundamental accounting topics. I'm thinking specifically of the overhaul proposed for commitments and contingencies and the exploratory review of equity method investments under SSAP number 48. What's the latest on these projects after the spring meeting?
The short answer is that there has not been very much movement on these topics yet. As you recall, the proposal for commitments and contingencies aims to create a single comprehensive framework by adding a new definition for commitments and contingent commitments and consolidating all disclosures in one place. At the spring meeting, the Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group heard initial feedback from interested parties who pointed out that the new definition needed additional clarity. They said that there's a real risk that the new rules could be applied inconsistently across the industry.
So there isn't something that's going to be adopted quickly. What are the next steps?
Exactly. At the spring meeting, the Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group directed the NEAC staff to work directly with the industry to refine the proposal. They also sent a referral to the Capital Adequacy Task Force to get input on how these new definitions might impact RBC. The key takeaway is that this is a longer-term project and that the final version may look different after this collaborative process.
Now, what about the other one we discussed, the review of equity method investments under SSAP number 48? Last time you described it as more exploratory.
It is still exploratory. As a reminder, this project isn't about one specific rule change, but a broad review of SSAP number 48. The proposal asks for feedback on a range of issues, including the timing for recognizing value changes, the accounting for goodwill, and reporting of negative investment income, and the use of related party codes. The goal is to evaluate guidance in SSAP 48 to determine if it is clear and consistently applied as intended.
And what was the update from the spring meeting?
The Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group was asked to extend the comment period because of the complexity of the topic and the potential for significant system changes that may be needed based on this proposal. As the next step, Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group directed NEAC staff to form a small, dedicated group, including regulators and industry representatives, to review the SSAP and develop and draft proposed revisions. So a lot more to come on this.
For both of these foundational topics, the message seems to be change is coming, but it will be a deliberate and collaborative process. The last accounting topic I want to talk about is the change related to funding agreement-backed notes, or FABNs. In our last episode, you talked about regulators seeking more transparency for these instruments. Has there been any movement there?
Yes. The Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group exposed revisions to SSAP number 52 that would add extensive new disclosure requirements for FABNs and other similar structures. The goal is to give regulators clear view of the risks in this growing market.
What kind of new disclosures are we talking about?
Insurers would need to break down their funding agreement by the type of issuances, whether they are backed by commercial paper, repurchase agreement, or loans, and disclose the carrying value of any pledged collateral. They'd also have to report on agreements with put features, those with terms that are different from special purpose vehicle issuance, and provide a maturity distribution. The intent is for these disclosures to be effective for year-end 2026.
Thanks, Olga. Let's shift from accounting to a few topics related to risk-based capital. The first one I want to explore is related to RBC treatment of collateralized loan obligations, or CLOs. This has been a hot topic for a while. Could you walk us through the latest discussions?
Certainly. The Risk-Based Capital Investment Risk Evaluation Working Group re-exposed a proposal to create a more detailed RBC structure for CLOs, separating them from long-term bonds. But the real headline here is the detailed modeling work presented by the American Academy of Actuaries that also included new proposed factors.
What did their modeling reveal?
The Academy analyzed U.S. broadly syndicated loan CLOs and found an important risk driver for these instruments, tranche thickness. This refers to the amount of loss specific tranche can absorb before it's wiped out. Their analysis showed that CLOs rated BBB minus and lower, there is a significant difference in risks between thin and thick tranches. They identified a 4% tranche thickness as the dividing line.
So how would this translate into new RBC factors?
The Academy presented two options. The first option is simple, using a single set of factors based only on the credit rating. The second option is more complex, applying different factors for tranches that are thicker or thinner than the 4% threshold. This would mean thin BBB minus tranche would be getting a significantly higher capital charge than a thick one, reflecting its higher risk.
Olga, what has the reaction been to these proposals?
Well, while some regulators agree that tranche thickness is a key risk driver, others raised concerns with the two-tiered approach. They worry it would create a cliff effect where a tranche just below the 4% line gets a much higher charge than one just above it. There's also the risk that deals could be structured to just barely meet the 4% threshold to achieve a lower capital charge. Finally, a tranche's thickness isn't static. It can change over the life of CLO. The discussion is now focused on whether these operational challenges outweigh the benefits of more risk-sensitive approach.
It sounds like a classic tension between precision and practicality. While we are on the topic of complex assets, the spring meeting also addressed RBC for collateral loans reported on Schedule BA. What's developing there?
Yes. The Life RBC Working Group re-exposed a proposal to revise those RBC charges based on the type of underlying collateral as previously adopted by the Statutory Accounting Principles Working Group. The goal is to better align the capital requirements with the risk in the underlying collateral by assigning a look-through RBC factor based on the type of collateral. This is an alternative to the previously exposed proposal to just applying a flat 20% reduction to recognize the lack of loan-to-value information in the statutory filings.
Has there been any feedback on either of these approaches?
Yes. Although some regulators agreed that the more granular approach was reasonable, others raised questions about how they can get comfortable with valuations used in loan-to-value calculations and that would be used in the more granular approach, specifically for collateral assets that don't have readily observable market prices.
That's a crucial point. If regulators aren't confident in the value of the collateral, they won't be comfortable with the level of over-collateralization. Where does that leave the proposal?
It leaves it in a state of active dialogue. Based on discussion at the spring meeting, the Life RBC Working Group included specific questions in the exposure asking for solutions to address regulator concern about fair value of assets with unobservable inputs, whether there should be lower reduction to the look-through approach, if the fair value of collateral cannot be observed in the market, and whether an alternative tiering structure is appropriate such that 80% of loan-to-value is at the midpoint of the tier. One other point of discussion I wanted to mention is the effective date. Industry has been requesting a 2027 implementation. Although some regulators hoped to get it done for 2026 year-end, many supported the 2027 effective date. So for both CLOs and collateral loans, the direction is towards more granular, risk-based capital charges, but the final details are still being worked out.
Thanks, Olga. Let's talk a little bit about some actuarial topics. VM22 for non-variable annuities continues to be a major area of focus. What were the key developments from the spring meeting?
You're right. Although VM22 has been adopted, work is ongoing. There are two topics I will highlight. First is the ongoing discussion about retrospective application. The VM22 subgroup exposed a new set of questions and a detailed approach developed by interested parties that would allow insurers to optionally apply VM22 to in-force business after notifying their domiciliary regulator. There is still a lot of debate around this, especially concerning potential reserve decreases and how to ensure consistency.
And the second topic?
The other hot topic has been around reinvestment guardrails, specifically for pension risk transfer or PRT business. Life Actuarial Task Force exposed a proposal to modify the guardrail requirements for PRT. The thinking is that the unique long-term nature of PRT warrants different spread and default assumptions. Some regulators are on board, but others are concerned about creating a special carve-out for one product line. It is definitely a space to watch.
As we look to the future, we can't ignore the impact of technology. At the end of our last episode, you mentioned that we hadn't even touched on artificial intelligence yet. It felt like a bit of a cliffhanger, hinting at the next major frontier for regulatory focus. What can you tell us about the NAIC's work in this area?
You're right, Sean. It's no longer just a topic for future discussion. The NAIC is taking concrete, systematic steps to get its arms around AI. The Big Data and Artificial Intelligence Working Group has moved from theory to practice by launching a formal pilot program for its new AI system evaluation tool. This is a tangible step towards building a framework for regulatory oversight of AI in the insurance industry.
An evaluation tool sounds interesting. Is this something insurers will have to fill out, like a new annual statement schedule?
Not exactly. It's more of a structured guide for regulators to supplement their existing examination. The tool is designed to help regulators understand how an insurer is using AI across its business operations.
And you said this is now in pilot phase. What does that look like?
The pilot process officially kicked off in March and is planned to run through September of this year. Participants include 12 state insurance departments. Most of these states have selected between 2 and 10 of their domestic insurers to be a part of the pilot. These are primarily life and property and casualty insurers. For a number of insurers, this process is already underway.
Can you tell us what insights the regulators hope to gain from this pilot?
The short answer is they are testing practical application of this tool. They want to generate insights to determine whether the tool helps insurers clearly explain their AI governance system to regulators and whether it helps regulators better understand how insurers use AI systems. The pilot will also help generate long-term recommendations for market conduct and financial risk assessment review process. Based on what is learned, regulators will be able to better understand how to support the ongoing improvements and development of tools and identify what additional regulatory training may be needed in the future.
You said the pilot is scheduled to wrap up in September. What will be the next steps after that? When might the industry see a final adopted version of this tool?
The timeline is quite ambitious. Once the pilot concludes, the working group plans to quickly analyze feedback and update the tool. Their goal is to present the updated and improved tool for formal adoption at the NAIC Fall 2026 meeting.
That's a crucial takeaway. This pilot program is essentially a preview of future regulatory expectation. Thanks, Olga, for shedding light on what is sure to be one of the most transformative topics for the industry in the coming years. We've talked a lot about how regulators are seeking more transparency into insurers' own operations and AI usage. But a great deal of the sophisticated modeling and data analytics now comes from outside the company. Is the NAIC also turning its attention to third-party vendors that provide these critical tools?
Absolutely, Sean. This is major area focus. The third-party data and models working group has been developing and debating a proposed risk-based regulatory framework aimed directly at these vendors. The core purpose is to give regulators a window into the data and models that insurers are using to establish clear governance standards for things like data integrity and consumer protection.
A framework for vendors sounds like a significant expansion of regulatory oversight. How would that work in practice?
One of the most debated components of the proposal is a requirement for all third-party vendors in the space to register with the state insurance department. To get this registered status, a vendor would have to provide information about their own internal governance program and give regulators access to their models and data. This wouldn't just be a high-level marketing material. We're talking about detailed model documentation, input and output specifications, the result of any validation, performance or bias testing, and even change logs.
That sounds like a heavy lift for the vendors and a major shift in the regulator-vendor relationship. What has the reaction been?
There has been significant concern from many in the industry. The idea of mandatory registration is one of the main sticking points. Vendors and insurers argue that it could stifle innovation, reduce competition by creating high barriers to entry, and impose a huge operational burden. They also see the scope of the proposal as too broad. And of course, there are major concerns about confidentiality and protecting valuable intellectual property.
Have those that expressed these concerns proposed an alternative?
Yes, they suggested that instead of mandatory registration, there be a voluntary risk-based process. They also want to narrow the scope to focus only on model vendor for specific high-risk functions like pricing and underwriting, while excluding general data vendors. And they're advocating for consistent nationwide approach to prevent insurers from having to follow different processes based on individual state requirements.
It sounds like a classic debate between regulatory control and potential challenges with practical application. Has there been other feedback on the proposal?
Yes, some regulators and consumer advocates are supporting the current draft. Although regulators clarified that the framework is not intended to disrupt the marketplace and that they will take the comments into consideration.
So where does that leave the proposal? What are the next steps?
For now, the discussion continues. The working group has made it clear they are taking all the comments into consideration, so the proposal is by no means final. The key takeaway for our listeners is this. Regardless of whether the final framework is mandatory or voluntary, the insurance regulators are looking for more line of sight into third-party models. Insurers should follow this topic closely, as it will fundamentally shape their relationship with their data and model vendors and their own responsibilities for the tools they use.
Olga, before we wrap up, you've covered a lot of ground for us today, from regulatory priorities and accounting changes to actuarial updates and emerging technology. With so many moving parts and major proposals in play, what would you highlight as the most important takeaway for our listeners as they navigate the changes ahead? Any final advice or words of encouragement as the industry faces this next chapter?
As we look ahead, I'd emphasize that the pace of change in the insurance industry is not slowing down. It is driven by regulatory innovation, emerging risks, and evolving technology. My advice for listeners is to stay engaged and proactive, follow the regulatory developments closely, assess your organization's readiness for change, and foster collaboration with regulators, vendors, and industry peers.
Great advice as always. Thanks again for joining us, Olga, and for sharing your expertise.
My pleasure, Sean.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Insurance Insights, a financial reporting podcast. Before we go, we're excited to announce that the 38th annual KPMG Insurance Industry Conference will take place September 17th to 18th. You can attend in person at KPMG Lakehouse or join us online. To stay informed about conference details and registration, be sure to follow the KPMG US Financial Services page on LinkedIn. We'll be back after the summer NAIC meeting to unpack those developments.